You're a bright young man. This monkey business is in your blood, under your skin. You're not getting out, you're just getting in. You're only getting started. I've every faith in you. And one day in the future, it'll be you sitting here in my place, telling some young Turk the facts of life.
And they are, Mr. Temple.
You're born, you take shit. Get out in the world, you take more shit. Climb a little higher, take less shit. Till one day you're up in the rarefied atmosphere and you've forgotten what shit even looks like. Welcome to the layer cake, son.
Welcome to the very first episode in the File and Claw audiobook archives. So today we will begin a new book called Triumphant Plutocracy, the story of American public life from 1870 to 1920. The author of this book, Richard Franklin Pettigrew, was neither a historian nor a writer. But he was the first senator from the state of South Dakota, and at a very tempestuous time in America, he was allowed to take a deep, hard look at the inner machinery of this country, and he saw what it was really all about. And thank goodness he wrote a book. In this book, he's going to cover a range of topics and people. Some of them you'll know, some of them you won't. He goes on about politics and political parties and presidents and senators and big business and trusts and the military. He flies off the handle. He writes in capital letters, all capital letters at some points. He calls politicians names, and he makes some pretty bold claims in this book. And I don't really want to ruin all the surprises in there, but let's just hit a few of the highlights just to whet your appetite so you stick with this. This is from the table of contents. Land grabbing, banks and bankers, money, trusts, the railroads, plutocracy. Who made the Constitution? The Supreme Court of the United States. Senates and senators, 10 presidents, business and politics, anti-imperialism, benevolent assimilation, the U.S. in the course of empire, war profiteers, the Russian Revolution, the League to Perpetuate War, and that's it. So anyways, there's, 34 chapters in this book. So it's kind of long, only about 400 pages, I guess. So yeah, there is some hot stuff in here. But I don't want to give it all away. I want you to, you know, actually read the book. But, I mean, he details some very divisive issues in this book. And he calls out corruption left and right. He's not afraid to do it. He gets in there with the pliers and the blowtorch. And, you know, he mixes it up. So, let's talk a little bit here real quick about the title of the book. Because it's going to be a little confusing, but I'm going to try to break it down so you understand here, because, well, there's two printings of the book. So the book Triumphant Plutocracy was actually self-published by Rich Pettigrew in New York in January of 1922. And you can tell that it's self-published. Now, nowadays, I know people self-publish all the time, and the books are real good, but it's pretty apparent that he didn't have an editor for the book. Oftentimes it repeats itself. There's like a paragraph lifted from the beginning of a chapter and just put again at the end for no reason. So you're rereading things. There's spelling errors. There's some pretty bad grammatical mistakes in there, etc., etc. And so it makes the book a little hard to read. However, in October of 1922, a full 9 months after the private publishing, a proper print job was done on it by the, once again, the Charles H. Kerr and Company of Chicago. Surprise, surprise, these guys seem to print all the divisive books back then. The only thing is, though, this time when they printed the book, it was printed under the title of Imperial Washington, not Triumphant Plutocracy. So I've kind of browsed the two of them. They're both available online from Google and the Internet Archive, I want to say. So check them out and you can compare too. But it appears to me that Imperial Washington has kind of been cleaned up and edited for errors and things like that. And so that's the copy I'm going to be reading from. However, I must say that the name Triumphant Plutocracy is so much better. And I have no idea why they switched the names, but we're going to be using it just for the purposes of this podcast presentation. So just know that even though I'm calling the book Triumphant Plutocracy, I'm reading from Imperial Washington, but they're the same book essentially. Anyways, I don't want to be too long in it because the first part is kind of long, but let's take a brief look at Richard Pettigrew and see what this guy was all about and kind of what his bona fides are. And for that, we'll turn to Wikipedia for the brief and, as always, whitewashed and mainline history of the man. Alright, so this is coming straight from Wikipedia. I'm just going to quote. Richard Franklin Pettigrew, born July 23rd, 1848, died October 5th, 1926, was an American lawyer, surveyor, and land developer. He represented the Dakota Territory in the U.S. Congress, and after the Dakotas were admitted as states, he was the first United States Senator from South Dakota. Pettigrew was born in Ludlow, Windsor County, Vermont, and moved with his parents to Wisconsin in 1854. The family settled in Rock County near Union, Wisconsin. He studied law in Iowa and entered the law department of the University of Wisconsin-Madison in 1867. He moved to Dakota in 1869 to work with a United States deputy surveyor. He settled in Sioux Falls, where he practiced law and engaged in surveying and real estate. He was a member of the Territorial House of Representatives and served on the Territorial Council. He was elected as a Republican to the U.S. House, serving from March 4, 1881 to March 4, 1883, so 2 years. He was an unsuccessful candidate for re-election in 1882, but returned to the Territorial Council from 1885 to 1889. When South Dakota was admitted as a state, Pettigrew was elected as South Dakota's first senator to the United States Senate. He served from November 2, 1889 to March 4, 1901. He introduced a bill to fund the structure, recommending the Native Sioux Court site to be used for construction of the state's first federal building. He was re-elected in 1894, but left the Republican Party on June 17, 1896 to join the Silver Republicans. a faction of the Republican Party which opposed the party's position in support of the monetary gold standard. He was an unsuccessful candidate for re-election in 1900. In the presidential election of 1900, while still in the Senate, he was a delegate and a major figure in the National Political Convention of the Populist Party, held in Sioux Falls, that convened on May 9, 1900 and lasted 3 days. The party endorsed William Jennings Bryan as its candidate. After his time in the Senate, Pettigrew first practiced law in New York, but soon returned to Sioux Falls and was active in politics and business until his death in that city. And then they talk about where he's buried, that he left his house as a museum, and it's maintained by the city of Sioux Falls to this day. The Pettigrew Museum is designed to emulate how a person of Pettigrew's stature would have lived at the turn of the century. Houses filled with antiques from the early 1900s and Pettigrew's personal collection of artifacts. And he was also instrumental in founding many local communities around Sioux Falls by donating land. And the only other interesting little book here, or note I should say, is that in 1917, while being interviewed by a journalist from the Argus Leader, Pettigrew offered his opinion that the First World War was a capitalist scheme intended to further enrich the wealthy, and he urged young men to evade the draft. Boy, doesn't that tell you a lot about him, huh? A local United States attorney secured a felony indictment of Pettigrew for suspicion of violating the Espionage Act of 1917. This same charge, for which socialist leader Eugene V. Debs was then presently serving a 10-year federal prison sentence. Pettigrew assembled a high-powered legal defense team headed up by his close personal friend, prominent attorney Clarence Darrow. The trial was repeatedly delayed, and eventually the charge against him was dropped. Pettigrew had the formal document of indictment framed and prominently displayed in his home next to a framed copy of the United States Declaration of Independence, where it remains this day as part of the exhibits of the Pettigrew House and Museum. And yeah, what a what a contrast that presents. They have the Declaration of Independence, that lofty declaration, sitting next to a copy of an indictment for being a enemy of the state because you spoke your mind. So how about that freedom of speech, huh? That's all. And that's really all they have here. They said he wrote 2 books, one called The Course of Empire, which was published in 1920, and one called Imperial Washington, which we are going to read, 1922, and it was a reprint of the originally published Triumphant Plutocracy. So yeah, so that's it, short and sweet, but I mean, you kind of get a little taste of this guy in his thing. I mean, could you imagine the balls to, during the war, call it out as a money-making scheme, and he told people to evade the draft. Man, that takes some stones, you know? And so, you'll see in his book, I mean, there's no holds barred. It was only just a few short years before he passed on, and thank goodness he wrote it and let it rip, because in here, I mean, he's going to call out the corruption, and it's so blatant, you're going to be shocked. And the most interesting thing is that this comes from a senator, you know, somebody who is inside the machine, so it's not like some outside observer trying to write about it. I mean, this guy was there, he sat in there, he got to see how the wheels turned and who greased them, so to speak, I guess. And it just comes from such an authority that that's what makes it so impressive. I mean, anybody could write some of the stuff he does in here, but the fact that he was there and he witnessed it, and he knows the people, and he can recall personal conversations with, we're talking about robber barons and presidents and, you know, political movers and shakers. You're not going to hear about that from anybody today. You're not going to be a senator. You think John Boehner's going to come tell you that America's owned by a bunch of corporations? Or John McCain or Lindsey Graham or Nancy Pelosi? Think any of these guys are going to come in here and tell you that America's just goes to war and builds empires to help its big business buddies? You think Bush or Obama or Clinton, you know, any of these people are going to stand up and say that America's owned, that we rewrite history whenever it suits the purpose of business and empire? And these people are all judicious bribe takers in the Congress? Come on. Nobody today is going to tell you that. You got to go all the way back almost 100 years now. Almost 100. Not quite. But almost. And then maybe if you're lucky, like I did, you stumble upon this guy, Rich Pettigrew. And he lays it out for you way back then. And as always, as I've been doing in the America's 1% podcast, just note how things don't change, or haven't changed, I should say, from then to there. And that was really the time when the robber barons and the elites were really shoring up their power in this country, and where they kind of hit critical mass. And, you know, from the mid to late 1800s to the maybe the 40s and 50s in this country is when they really locked everything up. And so he was in there during this short period of this time, and he's really going to let you know what it's all about. So let's get down to it. I'm excited to read this book. I don't think many people have read this. I haven't found anywhere else where they talked about this book. So let's do it. As always, with the audiobook archives, let me just lay out the format here. I'll try to keep the recordings to 1 hour. Usually that means only a chapter or two. If there's any footnotes in the book, I will note them in the reading and post them on the website so you can go there and read them if you find anything incredible, you know. If there's long footnotes, I'll actually read them into the book. I love the little commentary that some writers put in their footnotes. That can be really illuminating. So I'll read those into the actual book as well. Also, if there's no footnotes, I won't. So, you know, and this is kind of a personal memoir, so I don't know if he puts footnotes in here or not. But, let's see, I'll be stopping to spell any last names, because I tend to butcher them. And also, if there's any real archaic words, I'll give a definition to them too, because it helps me, and I read these books for myself, or I was originally, now I'm sharing them, but I originally read these for myself, and it really helps me. So if it helps me, maybe it'll help you. Maybe you'll get something out of it. Because I have to look stuff up all the time. You know, I'm not some kind of genius or something. I mean, I use the dictionary just like everybody else. Yeah, other than that, God, let's get into it. This is Triumphant Plutocracy, also known as Imperial Washington. The Story of American Public Life from 1870 to 1920 by R.F. Pettigrew, formerly United States Senator from South Dakota, published by the Charles H. Kerr and Company Cooperative of Chicago, October 1st, 1922. And there's a publisher's note at the beginning, but I'm going to skip that. Let's get into it right now. This is the foreword. American Public Life. The American people should know the truth about American public life. They have been lied to so much and hoodwinked so often that it would seem only fair for them to have at least one straight-from-the-shoulder statement concerning this government, quote, of the people, by the people, and for the people, unquote, about whose inner workings the people know almost nothing. The common people of the United States, like the same class of people in every other country, mean well, but they are ill-informed. Floundering about in their ignorance, they are tricked and robbed by those who have the inside information and who, therefore, know how to take advantage of every turn in the wheel of fortune. The people voted for Roosevelt because he talked of trust busting at the same time that he was sanctioning the purchase of the Tennessee Coal and Iron Company by the Steel Trust. They supported Wilson because he kept us out of war at the same time that Wilson was making preparations to enter the war. The rulers can negotiate secret treaties at home and abroad, the people knowing nothing of either the theory or the practice of secret diplomacy commit all sorts of follies for which they themselves must later foot the bill. At the present moment, the American people are being taught Americanism, taught by the same gentry who are making away with billions of dollars, sometimes quote-unquote legally, and sometimes without any sanction in the law. The most prominent among the leaders of the Americanization campaign were the most prominent among the war profiteers. They are the owners of resources and industries, the owners of America. It is from them that the preparedness agitation came in 1915 and 1916. And it is from them that the new preparedness agitation is coming now. There is a newspaper story in the New York Herald, November 7, 1920, which illustrates the point. The story, evidently inspired by the War Department, is devoted to a description of certain big guns and certain new forms of tanks that the government is at the present time busy manufacturing. The country was caught napping once, says the writer, but the War Department is going to be sure that the same thing does not happen again. Therefore, it is building up its machinery now while the country is still at peace. In this work, the War Department is assisted, quote, by some of the leading industrial spirits of the country, who are keeping up the same enthusiastic devotion to the service of their country they displayed in the war. A little army of dollar-a-year men headed by Benedict Crowell, former Assistant Secretary of War, has mobilized itself under the name of Army Ordnance Association, and is giving its valuable time to the country without costing the government a single cent. Unquote. And that man's name, Benedict Crowell, last name C-R-O-W-E-L-L. Who are the members of this quote-unquote little army of patriots? The Herald gives the answer in full. Besides Mr. Crowell, there are, in the Army Ordnance Association, William Wheeler Coleman, president of the Bucyrus Company of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, Charles Elliott Warren, past president of the American Bankers Association, Ralph Cruz of the law firm of Sherman and Sterling, New York City, Guy Eastman Tripp, chairman of the board of directors of the Westinghouse Corporation, Samuel McRoberts of the National City Bank of New York, Waldo Calvin Bryant, president of the Bryant Electric Company, Frank Augustus Scott, former chairman of the War Industries Board, Robert P. Lamont, president of the American Steel Foundries of Chicago, and C. L. Harrison of the First National Bank of Cincinnati. And, God, let me hit all those names. First up, you have William Wheeler Coleman. His last name, C-O-L-E-M-A-N. And his company is the Bucyrus Company of Milwaukee. And I'll spell that B-U-C-Y-R-U-S, Bucyrus. Next up, we had Charles Elliott Warren, the past president of the American Bankers Association. His last name, Warren, W-A-R-R-E-N. Ralph Cruz of the law firm of Sherman & Sterling, his last name is C-R-E-W-S. Guy Eastman Tripp, who is on the board of directors of the Westinghouse Company, his name, last name is T-R-I-P-P. Let's see, Samuel McRoberts, his last name M-C-R-O-B-E-R-T-S. He's of National City Bank. Waldo Calvin Bryant, his last name B-R-Y-A-N-T. Frank Augustus Scott, his last name S-C-O-T-T. Robert P. Lamont of the American Steel Foundries of Chicago, last name L-A-M-O-N-T. And C.L. Harrison of First National Bank of Cincinnati, his last name, H.A.R.R.I.S.O.N. Continuing with the book now, what do these patriotic businessmen hope to gain by their devotion to the preparedness program of the War Department? The answer appears later in the same article. Quote, it is the desire to keep abreast of the world's performances and ordnance that has prompted the War Department to ask for an increased appropriation next year. The department's appropriation last year was $377,246,944. The estimates for this next year call for an appropriation of approximately $814 million, unquote. The difference, or $435 million, represents the value of contracts that will go to the business interests of the United States. Again, bankers, lawyers, manufacturers, and businessmen are going to save the country, not by keeping us out of war, but by getting ready for the next war. It is these men who dominate the life and thought as well as the industries of these United States. And it is just such men that have been in control of the United States ever since I entered the Senate 30 years ago. It is 50 years since I began to take an interest in public affairs. During those years, I have been participating, more or less actively, in public life. First as a government surveyor, then as a member of the legislature of Dakota, as a member of the House of Representatives, and finally as a member of the United States Senate. Since 1880, I have known the important men in both the Republican and Democratic parties. I have known the members of the diplomatic corps. I have known personally the last 10 presidents of the United States, and I have known personally the leading businessmen who backed the political parties and who made and unmade the presidents. For half a century, I have known public men and have been on the inside of business and politics. Through all of that time, I have lived and worked with the rulers of America. When I entered the arena of public affairs in 1870, the United States, with a population of 38 millions, was just recovering from the effects of the Civil War. The economic life of the old slaveholding South lay in ruins. Even in the North, the panic of 1873 swept over the business world, taking its toll in commercial failures and unemployment and an increase in the number of tenant farmers. The policy of sending carpet-bagging rascals into the embittered South hindered reconciliation, and sectional differences prevented any effective cooperation between the two portions of the country. The result was a heavy loss in productive power and in political position. Through this period, the United States was an inconsequential factor in international affairs. The transformation from that day to this is complete. With three times the population, with sectionalism practically eliminated, with the South recovered economically and the economic power of the North vastly increased, with more wealth than any other five nations of the world combined, with the credit of the world in her hands, with large, undeveloped, or only slightly developed resources, with a unified population and a new idea of world importance, the United States stands as probably the richest and most influential among the great nations. I witnessed the momentous changes and participated in them. While they were occurring, I saw something else that filled me with dread. I saw the government of the United States enter into a struggle with the trusts, the railroads, and the banks, and I watched while the business forces won the contest. I saw the forms of Republican government decay through disuse, and I saw them betrayed by the very men who were sworn to preserve and uphold them. I saw the empire of business, with its innumerable ramifications, grow up around and above the structure of government. I watched the power over public affairs shift from the weakened structure of Republican political machinery to the vigorous new business empire. Strong men who saw what was occurring no longer went into politics. Instead, they entered in the field of industry, and with them the seat of government of the United States was shifted from Washington to Wall Street. With this shift, there disappeared from active public life those principles of Republican government that I had learned to believe were the means of safeguarding liberty. After the authority over public affairs had been transferred to the men of business, I saw the machinery of business pass from the hands of individuals into the hands of corporations, artificial persons created in the imagination of lawyers and given efficacy by the sanction of the courts and of the law. When I turned to the reading of American history, I discovered that these things had been going on from the beginnings of the government, that they had grown up with it and were an essential part of its structure. From surprise and disgust, I turned to analysis and reason, and for the past 20 years, I have been watching the public life of the United States with an understanding mind. For a long time, I have known what was going on in the United States. Today, I think that I know why it is going on. When I look back over the half century that has passed since I first entered public life, I can hardly realize that America, which I knew and believed in as a young man in the 20s, could have changed so completely in so short a time. Even when I know the reason for the change, it is hard to accept it as a reality. Many of the public men who have lived and worked in the United States during the past century have written their impressions of public affairs. Benton, Blaine, Grant, and Sherman discussed the public life of the middle of the last century. Since then, there have been many autobiographies and memoirs. I have read these books carefully, and it seems to me that not one of the writers is at the same time a student and a realist. First of all, they have written about politics, with very little or no attention to the economic forces that were shaping politics. In the second place, too many of them have written the agreeable things and left the disagreeable ones unsaid. In the third place, they have written what they believe should have happened rather than what actually did happen. Fourth, and by far the most important, each of these men has written as a member of a ruling class, pleased with himself, and satisfied that rule by his class was the best thing for the community. The pictures that these men give are like the decisions of our courts, built of precedents rather than realities. It is my ambition to tell my fellow countrymen what has happened during the half century that I have known public life. I know what went on because I saw it. I want others to have the same knowledge. During my public career, I have received very definite impressions, and I am anxious to pass those impressions on to others. I want to do this because I believe that my country is in danger. I believe that the liberties of the American people are already well nigh destroyed. I believe that we are moving forward to a crisis of immense significance to the future of the American people, and the ideas and ideals for which the United States has stood before the world. We are far along on the road to empire, and we are traveling faster towards that goal than any nation in history ever traveled. It is with that purpose and in that spirit that I have written this book, and it is in that spirit that I ask them to consider and ponder what I have said there. Man, I don't know what to say about that. I mean, what else is there to say? Yeah. I mean, I gotta tell you, I was just reading that. It started to flow so good. That was hot fire, let me tell you. You just got a blast of it right there. And that is some real unfiltered truth. That was a painting painted before your eyes. And if you didn't get it, just go back and listen to that again. I mean, that says it all. He saw the battle between Republican government and big business, and he saw the government lose. That's what he said. And with that, the seat of power transferred from Washington to Wall Street. I mean, that says it all. That was, wow, that was the thing. I'm telling you, I just started reading that, and it just started flowing, and I didn't want to stop. I'm surprised I got through it all without messing up, but woo! All right, here we go. Let's do this. Chapter 1, Land Grabbing. My first struggle with the business interests after I entered the Senate in 1889 came over the question of land grabbing. At that time, the federal government still owned millions of acres of valuable timber, mineral, and agricultural land that might easily have been utilized for public advantage instead of for private gain. The attorneys and other representatives that the vested interests maintained in Washington were busy grabbing this land. I set myself to save it for the people. I was thoroughly familiar with the public land laws of the United States, as I had been a practicing lawyer before the Land Department, a surveyor on the public domain, and besides that, I had planted a timber claim with white ash trees which stand today. I therefore sought appointment upon the Senate Committee on Public Lands, of which Preston B. Plum, his last name P-L-U-M-B, of Kansas, was chairman. In that position, I had an excellent opportunity to see land grabbing from the inside. The House passed a bill to repeal the timber culture law, quote, and for other purposes, unquote, in February 1890. When the bill reached the Senate, it was referred to the Committee on Public Lands, and Chairman Plum appointed Senator Walthall of Mississippi and me as a subcommittee to consider the bill. That senator's name is Walthall, W-A-L-T-H-A-L-L. I gave the matter very careful attention, and after some weeks of study and work, I reported the bill to the Senate in such a form that it involved a complete revision of the federal land laws. The bill, containing 19 sections, finally passed the Senate on the 16th of September, 1890. Immediately upon its passage, a conference was requested, and Senators Plum, Walthall, and Pettigrew were appointed as conference committee on the part of the Senate. In the House, the bill was referred to the Committee on Public Lands, which reported it back early in the next session of Congress, agreeing to the conference asked for by the Senate, and appointing three conferees, Payson of Illinois, Holman of Indiana, and Pickler of South Dakota. Those names, Payson, P-A-Y-S-O-N, Holman, H-O-L-M-A-N, and Pickler, P-I-C-K-L-E-R. Plum did not act with the conference committee. Walthall of Mississippi and myself took full charge of the work, and after many conferences we finally agreed upon and did report to each house a bill just as the Senate had passed it, with five additional sections, making 24 in all. The 24th section was as follows. Section 24, page 1103, 51st Congress, March 3, 1891. That the President of the United States may from time to time set apart and reserve in any state or territory having public land bearing forests in any part of the public lands wholly or in part covered with timber or undergrowth, whether of commercial value or not, as public reservations, and the President shall by public proclamation declare the establishment of such reservations and the limits thereof. I gave this section in full, first because it resulted in departure in public policy that was highly advantageous to the people of the United States, and second because it led to one of the most bitter-fought parliamentary struggles in which I have ever participated. Section 24 was placed in the bill at my suggestion to take the place of the timber culture law, which never had produced any timber. I had offered this section in the Senate Committee on Public Lands, but the Western senators were opposed to quote-unquote locking up the country in forest reservations. In conference, while I had some difficulty, I secured an agreement which included this section in the bill. Nothing was done under Section 24 until after Cleveland commenced his second term, and then he, as president, appointed a commission of Eastern people to go out into the Western country, Dakota, Wyoming, Colorado, and establish the forest reservations. These men rode about the country in a Pullman car and prescribed the boundaries of forest reservations without any discriminating judgment. For example, they established the reservation of Black Hills in South Dakota and embraced within its boundaries the city of Deadwood and the towns of Lead and Custer and Hill City, which contained thousands of people who were mining, home building, and getting the timber necessary for these activities from the surrounding forests. Once these reservations were established, it became impossible to cut any timber upon them. Consequently, the people who had made their homes in the reserved area were practically compelled to move. Since no law had been passed for the administration of these newly created reserves, the country was completely locked up. No new people could go in and settle, and those already there found themselves restricted on every hand. The result was a general dissatisfaction with the whole policy of forest reservations. I realized that unless some change was made, the whole policy would be discredited, and therefore I secured legislation suspending reservations already located until proper legislation could be secured for their administration. Finally, at my request, Wolcott, his name W-O-L-C-O-T-T, who was then at the head of the Geological Survey, prepared an amendment to the Sundry Civil Appropriation Bill, which I offered in the Senate, providing for the administration of these forests. After this law for administration was enacted, the Secretary of the Interior informed me that he would make the boundaries of the Black Hills Forest Reservation whatever I might recommend. I went out to the Black Hills, held meetings of the people, and explained to them the purpose of the forest reservation. In every instance, they passed resolutions in favor of being embraced with the forest reservation, as administered under the new laws. By this direct appeal to the people most intimately concerned, I was able to enlarge the reservation by over 200,000 acres. And just as an aside, well, there's an example of how things are supposed to work, but I have a feeling that Pettigrew's going to find out that's not how things actually work. Let's continue on here. When I returned to Washington, the Secretary of the Interior asked me to suggest such rules and regulations as would best enable his department to administer the forest reservations laws. In accordance with this request, I wrote out the rules and regulations which were afterwards adopted by him. I remember in one of the regulations that I provided for sowing the Black Hills spruce seed upon the snow in all the open parks and denuded places, so that when the snow melted, these seeds would sink down into the moist ground and immediately sprout and grow. And today there are many thousands more acres of forests in the Black Hills Reservation than there were when the law was enacted. Thus far, matters had gone very nicely. I had had a hard fight to get the policy of forest reservation adopted and the reservations themselves established. Now came the real fight, to hold them for the people. In the amendment which was added to the Sundry Civil Appropriation Bill, I inserted a provision that permitted any settler who was embraced within a forest reservation to exchange his land acre by acre for other government land outside of the reservation, Such a provision enabled settlers who had taken land before the establishment of reservations to take up a new quarter section in case they did not care to live under the reservation regulations. The conference committee of the two houses that considered the Sundry Civil Bill changed the wording of this section in such a way that the land grant railroads, which had received in all nearly 200 million acres of land, could exchange their land, if embraced within a forest reservation, for the very best land the government had remaining on the public domain outside of the reservation. Allison of Iowa was chairman on the part of the Senate, and Joe Cannon of Illinois is chairman on the part of the House. And their last name, Allison, A-L-L-I-S-O-N. I think his name's William Allison. And the other guy, Joe Cannon, his last name is spelled C-A-N-N-O-N. The conference report came to the Senate the day before the end of the session. Therefore, it was not printed, but was rushed through after having been read hurriedly by the clerk. I listened to the reading, but I did not notice this change of wording in my amendment, and so the monstrous proposition became a law. Of course, the conferees knew what they were doing when they slipped through this provision. Under it, the Interior Department ruled that the land-grant railroads could exchange their odd sections, embraced within a forest reservation, for the best remaining acres of the public domain. The right to make this exchange was worth at least $50 million to the land-grant railroads. I did not discover this change, made by the conference committee, until I learned that the Department of Interior was permitting the railroads to make these exchanges. As soon as I discovered this, I looked up the law and found what an enormous fraud had been practiced through the cunning of Senator Allison of Iowa, chairman of the Committee on Appropriations, and Joe Cannon, representative from Illinois, a banker and lawyer and chairman of the Committee on Appropriations in the House. Nearly 10 years had dragged along from the time I began to fight in favor of forest reservations until this fraud was perpetuated on the American people by these two representatives of business. In order to meet the situation, I presented an amendment to the Sundry Civil Bill on May 31st, 1900, 56th Congress, First Session, pages 6289 to 6298. Of the Congressional Record, which read as follows, quote, "And said superintendents, assistant inspectors, supervisors, and rangers shall, under the direction of the Secretary of the Interior, examine all lands within the boundaries of any forest reservation that belong to any land-grant railroad company, and have not heretofore been sold in good faith for a valuable consideration, and report to the Secretary the character and value of said land, and pending such examination and report, none of said land shall be exchanged for other land outside of the reservation." Unquote. It may be well to state at this point that the Central and Union Pacific Railroad had received grants by an act of Congress 20 miles wide, from the Missouri River on the west boundary of the state of Iowa straight across the continent to the Pacific Ocean, through the length of the states of Nebraska, Wyoming, Utah, Nevada, and California. The road was the odd sections on a strip 10 miles wide on each side of the tracks. The Northern Pacific Railroad received a grant of land 40 miles in width from some point in the state of Minnesota, clear through to the Pacific Ocean. This grant extended through the states of Minnesota, North Dakota, Montana, Idaho, and Washington. And the area granted included these odd sections throughout this entire region. These grants embraced the good and the bad land alike. Of necessity, they included large areas on the tops of the Rocky Mountains and the Cascade Range, and a great deal of desert land, whether by design or not, when the forest reservations were created, they embraced, indiscriminately, forested and non-forested districts. By some chance, they also embraced large areas of desert land. These deserts were probably embraced intentionally so that the railroads could exchange their odd sections of worthless desert land for lands of great value outside the reservation. After I had presented the amendment just referred to, I made a statement of these facts, after which the following significant debate took place. I quote it in order to show where certain senators lined up when it came to an issue between private interest and the public welfare. And this is going to come from Congressional Record, May 31, 1900, First Session, 56th Congress, page 6288. And the format of this is, as it appears in the Congressional Record, it will have the speaker's name and then what they say. So, here we go. Mr. Pettigrew. Mr. President, the amendment I propose is a provision for the protection and administration of forest reservation. 3 years ago, in an appropriation bill, we provided for the protection and administration of these reservations, and provided that any actual and bona fide settler who had taken a claim within a forest reservation, afterwards created, could exchange his land, if he desired to do so, for a like area of the public domain. It was the intention of the law to allow a settler whose land was embraced in any forest reservation to exchange his land, if he desired to do so, for lands outside of the reservations, acre for acre. But certain words were inserted under which the department has decided that a land-grant railroad can exchange the worthless lands, lands from which the timber has all been cut, tops of mountains, the inaccessible and snow-capped peaks of the Rockies and Sierra Nevadas, for the best land the government has, acre for acre. So they have swapped lands on the Cascade Range, which are covered forever with ice and snow, not worth a tenth of a cent an acre, for lands worth from $6 to $10 in the valleys of Washington and Oregon and Idaho and Montana, thus depriving the settlers of a chance to secure these lands, besides enlarging the grants of the railroads to that extent. Now, my amendment simply provides that these lands shall be inspected and examined by the officers who have charge of the reservations, and they shall report to the secretary the character of the lands that belong to these companies, so that in the future we can make a proper adjustment, not an adjustment by which they shall receive 1,000 times more than which they surrender, and that while the appraisement is going on no more exchanges shall be made. That is all that the amendment aims to accomplish, and it is one in the interest of the public beyond all questions, suspending the operation of a law which Congress would have never passed if it had been discussed. Mr. Allison, I wish to say that this amendment, as it appears to me, is general legislation. Certainly, on the statement made by the senator from South Dakota, it changes the existing law. I hope he will not press it on this bill, because if he does, we shall be obliged to make the point of order that it is proposed general legislation. Mr. Pettigrew, I wish to say that I do not believe it is subject to the point of order, because it prescribes the duties of these officers who are provided for and the method of the expenditure of the appropriation now in the bill. Therefore, I do not believe it is subject to the point of order. It seems to me, if it is possible to insert the amendment, we ought to do it and protect the government and the people of this country against the execution of a law which we never would have passed if we had known what it contained. I would like to ask the chairman, Mr. Pettigrew again, I should like to ask the chairman of the Committee on Appropriations if the Secretary of the Interior did not think the law should be entirely repealed. Mr. Allison. The Secretary did. Mr. Pettigrew. Did he not think there were great frauds being practiced under it? Mr. Allison. I have no doubt that is all true, but this is a subject we cannot deal with now. And the amendment was read again. Mr. Penrose, his last name P-E-N-R-O-S-E. Mr. Penrose, I make the point of order that this is general legislation and contrary to the rule. The President, pro tempore of the Senate, the chair has overruled that point of order. It has already been made. The question is on agreeing to the amendment. The amendment was then agreed to. Okay, and that's all from the Congressional Record. Allison of Iowa, Tom Carter of Montana, Chandler of New Hampshire, Platt of Connecticut, Aldrich of Rhode Island, Penrose of Pennsylvania, Walcott of Colorado, Hawley of Connecticut, all joined in the fight against me to see that the land-grant railroads were given this vast graft at the expense of the people of the United States and against the public welfare. And those names in there that we haven't covered yet, Tom Carter, his last name C-A-R-T-E-R, Chandler, his last name C-H-N-D-L-E-R, Platt of Connecticut, last name P-L-A-T-T, Aldrich of Rhode Island, a notorious name, his last name A-L-D-R-I-C-H, Penrose, got him. Walcott, already got him. Hawley, I don't think we've gotten that one. He was from Connecticut. H-A-W-L-E-Y. Continuing with the book now. This is but a typical case. The lawyers in the Senate always lined up against the people of the United States and in favor of the railroads and the other predatory interests who are the real government of the United States. This Senate debate is significant because it shows that rascality, graft, and public plunder are not political questions, especially insofar as the Senate of the United States is concerned. Damn, lay it on, brother. Oh, man, railroads and banks were the real government of the United States. He said it. He just threw it out there. He doesn't care. Good on you, Rich. Tell it like it was, man. Continuing with the book. Observe that Allison of Iowa, who had inserted the amendment making possible the exchange of these railroad lands, was among the first to attack my amendment and to insist that it should not go into the bill. Observe further that Tom Carter, chairman of the Republican National Committee, took the same side. It was he who figured in the scandalous affair during Harrison's second campaign for election, at which time he collected from Cramp, the shipbuilder, and his last name C-R-A-M-P, $400,000 and told Cramp where the money was to be expended. When Tom Carter died, he left a large fortune. This same debate was participated in by Bill Chandler of New Hampshire, Stewart of Nevada, and finally Penrose of Pennsylvania, who arose and for the second time raised the point of order against my amendment. And that guy's name back there, Stewart of Nevada, S-T-E-W-A-R-T. Penrose continued in public life for many years as a faithful servant and representative of the great predatory interests. He has never been a representative of the people of Pennsylvania or of the United States. Despite all of this opposition, my amendment was adopted without a roll call. The reason is plain. Neither these men nor their backers desire to have the amendment become a law, but the scandal connected with the exchange of the railroad lands had gained such publicity, and the amendment was so clearly in the public interest that they did not dare to kill it openly. Besides, this was an amendment to the Sundry Civil Bill, and could be changed in conference, and the conference report forced through the Senate on the last day of the session. Allison of Iowa was called Pussyfoot, Pussyfoot Allison by his fellow senators because of his cunning, his unscrupulous rascality, and his suavity, and he could be relied upon to throw out the bill as reported from the conference committee anything that threatened property interests. So the bill passed the Senate and went to conference. Allison was chairman of the conference on the part of the Senate and Joe Cannon on the part of the House. The conference struck out my amendment adopted by the Senate and inserted in its place the following: that all sections of land made in lieu of a tract covered by an unperfected bona fide claim or by a patent included within a public forest reservation, as provided in the Act of June 4, 1897, shall be confined to vacant, surveyed, non-mineral public lands which are subject to homestead entry, not exceeding in area the tract covered by such claim or patent. The conference simply struck out the Senate amendment and inserted the original clause that they had placed in the Sundry Civil Bill of 1897, and under which the fraudulent exchange had taken place. The change would have permitted the railroads to continue the exchange of their worthless lands for the best of the government land, and thus to plunder the public domain. The conference report came up in the Senate on the day before adjournment. I was watching to see what had been done with my amendment, for I knew Allison and Cannon were but paid attorneys of the railroad. When the amendment was read, 56th Congress, first session, Congressional Record, page 6690. Mr. Pettigrew, I should like to understand the paragraph in relation to non-mineral lands. As I understand it, as read from the Secretary's desk, it permits a continued exchange by the land grant railroad companies of the worthless lands in the forest reservations for the best land the government has. Is that correct? Mr. Allison, I do not so understand it. The amendment provides for the exchange of surveyed lands only, and not of unsurveyed lands. Mr. Pettigrew, but it allows the exchange. Mr. Allison, it allows the exchange of surveyed lands. Mr. Pettigrew, Mr. President, this conference report provides that lands where a railroad company has cut off all the timber or the land on the snow-capped peaks of mountains, if they are within a forest reservation, can be exchanged for the best lands the government owns acre for acre, for timberlands. Hundreds of thousands of acres have already been exchanged, and yet, although the Senate placed upon this bill an amendment which would stop that practice, the conference committee brings in a report to continue it. And that's the end of the congressional record there. I wish to call particular attention to the statements made by Allison and Walcott that only surveyed land could be exchanged. This statement is specifically contradicted by the wording of their own amendment. The falsity of the statement was well known to them, yet they made it for the purpose of deceiving the Senate. A number of the faithful servants of the plutocrats distinguished themselves signally in this debate. Among them were Senators Walcott of Colorado and Hawley of Connecticut. Senator Walcott, who came into the Senate without a dollar, retired from that body with a large fortune. He was always eager to get into the record as having produced laughter on the part of the senators. He considered his effort in the interest of the robbery of the public domain particularly worthy of credit. Old Hawley of Connecticut was always a champion of the interests. As long as I knew him, he was mentally incapacitated from comprehending anything except the interests of the big business groups with which he always acted. He had an intellect like the soil of Connecticut, so poor by nature that it could not be exhausted by cultivation. Damn. Oh, man, you just took a jab at that guy. The amendment, as modified by the Committee on Conference, was finally agreed to. Because if we did not agree to the Senate Civil Sundry Bill, with this amendment in it, an extra session would have been necessary. Thus, the fraud was perpetuated and the continued grabbing of public lands made possible. The fraud thus deliberately ratified by Congress after all the facts were known, caused me to wonder what forces were in control of the government, and convinced me that the lawyers who composed two-thirds of both houses of Congress were but the paid attorneys of the exploiters of the American people, and that both political parties were but the tools in the hands of big business that were used to plunder the American people. The frauds begun under Cleveland, a Democratic president, were enlarged and completed under McKinley, a Republican president. Oh man, this guy's nailing it. He's totally nailing it. Look around today. You got all the crap that started under G.W. Bush. And really, it didn't even start under him, but people will blame it on him. And then what happens? The next guy comes in. He's supposed to be a 180. Oh, he's a Democrat. He does the same crap. It's the same stuff, and it'll be the same thing when a Republican takes over from the Obama. Or maybe it won't happen like that. Maybe it'll be a Democrat. But next time a Republican gets in, they're just going to do the same stuff over and over. There's no difference. There's never been a difference. Rich Pettigrew is laying it out right here. He's hitting the nail on the head. He said the frauds that began under a Democratic president carried on under a Republican one. No difference. You gotta get that through your head or you're just gonna be sucked into the vortex every freaking time. Continuing on, millions of acres of forest reservation were established in Montana, all within the grant of the Northern Pacific Railroad, where there was no timber or forests, only a little scrub pine that never was and never will be of any value for lumber or any kind of forest products. And that was done so that the Northern Pacific Railroad could exchange its odd sections of worthless desert for scrip, acre for acre, and this scrip sells from $8 to $10 per acre, and can be located on any land the government owns anywhere within our broad domain. And the desert for which this scrip was exchanged was not, and is not worth, 10 cents per acre. This is the story of one small event in the great drama of American public life that had been unfolding all around me. I have told it in detail because it shows, as well as anything that I ever learned, the fate that lay in wait for any measure aimed to promote the public welfare. When I began this fight for the enactment of forest legislation, I believed that we were enjoying a system of popular government in the United States. By the time the fight was ended, I understood that the country was being run by plunderers in the interest of capital. And that's the end of chapter one. I told you this guy ain't gonna pull no punches, man. He's throwing it out there. He's like, I was a fool. I was naive. How could I have known? And he went in there, had his first little fight with the robber barons, and walked out of there a jaded, jaded man. But we must thank him for that because you know what? This is some real history from an authoritative source. I mean, you can take this and say like, oh yeah, you think the government's still working on your side? Yeah, you think it's not controlled by businesses? Let me quote a United States senator. And that's strong. And he lays it out here. He says these people rule America, they run the government, and they do nothing. The whole thing is organized for nothing more than plundering the American people. And I don't think you can look around now and not you know, start to see that. Everyone I talk to, people understand that something's not right, but they don't know what it is. But they can look around and see that, you know, things aren't working how we've been told they're supposed to work. And it's pretty obvious. And by reading this history, you can start to see that, well, some people had insights about this, and, you know, this has been going on for a long time. So, I think this book is going to be real, real powerful. And already is. I mean, that intro in the first chapter, it was kind of long, but he had some hard-hitting stuff in there. And you can already see how the fraud and corruption was so rampant during that time, and all throughout history, you know, as we've seen, if you're watching the history, or reading the history, or listening to the history of America's 1% podcast, you're seeing that this has been going on forever. This is like, these are the pillars that the structure is built on, the foundation is built on, is corruption and greed and power and manipulation and bribery. I hate to say it. It's not liberty and the Bill of Rights and the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence. I think those were nice, but they were essentially a dead letter. And I think you have a hard time arguing that once you read these books. But anyways, I know I ran over an hour. Let's wrap it up. This is the first episode in the File and Claw audiobook archives. Join us next time. As always, I think I'm going to be releasing these on Thursdays. So check it out. I'm not 100% sure on that yet. So it'll be, or the history of the 1% on Tuesday, and then miscellaneous audiobook archive on Thursday. I'm thinking that's how it's going to go. But I'm not 100% on that. But anyway, stick around and check out the site for the latest and greatest. See what's coming new. And as always, this is the history you're not supposed to know, so make sure you forget everything you just heard.